my friend, and welcome to the Strandcast, the official podcast of Strand Bookstore, your favorite independent bookstore located at 828 Broadway at 12th Street here in New York City. My name is Boyce Terrell Allen. I'm your host and interviewer. Strand is known worldwide for our 18 miles of books and for mugs and for socks and things that you put books into. And now we have a podcast, the Strandcast. Every other week, we'll bring you long-form conversations with writers from all different genres, discussing their craft, their lives, and more. And on this week, on the Strandcast, I talk to yoga instructor Eddie Stern. Eddie is the author of One Simple Thing, a new look at the science of yoga and how it can transform your life. Eddie's informative book explains why yoga and meditation should be a part of your life if you're looking for a little more happiness, and who isn't? One Simple Thing is the book for you, whether yoga and meditation are already a part of your life or if they've still remained unchecked on your list of 2019 goals. Hey, I know the year is about half over, but you know, it's never too late to feel good. Before we get to the conversation, Strand Books is open 7 days a week from 9:30 a.m. until 10:30 p.m. and 24/7 online at strandbooks.com, where you can order books. We ship internationally. You can check out our many in-store events. Plus, you can sign up for our newsletter. Here it is, without further ado, my conversation with Eddie Stern. Enjoy. So first thing, one of the quotes that you had in the book that really just like stood out for me, and I've been holding on to like for the past week. So I want to read it so I do not get it wrong. Thoughts can't dwell in a mind that doesn't indulge them, and thoughts are stories. You remember that?
All right.
Okay. When did you learn that for yourself?
Ah, what a great opening question.
Thank you.
So, well, thoughts are definitely stories. Like, what's a story? A story has, you know, it has a plot. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. Most stories repeat themselves, mm-hmm. like in all of the great storybooks and mm-hmm. in the movies and in theater and like wherever you look.
Yeah.
We're just, all the mythologies are repetition mm-hmm. of stories, of the patterns of behavior. And thoughts are basically patterns of words strung together in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
To lead to a particular outcome.
Yes.
And the way that the mind works according to the yoga teachings, according to Patanjali, mm-hmm. is that we have particular patterns, and these are called samskaras, and that's a mental impression. And the mental impression is due to environment, where we grew up, how mm-hmm. we grew up. It is also part of our DNA, so it's genetic. And it's also karmic, that there are subtle seeds within us that mm-hmm. we bring with us into this life that express themselves, these seeds express themselves yeah. as our body, as our emotions, as our mind, mm-hmm. and as our patterns, and within that, as our desires, our inclinations. What are the things that I want to do? What do I not want to do? What is my purpose? Mm-hmm. What are my capabilities? And so all these subtle impressions are the seed patterns, which are then going to dictate how do we always look at the world, mm. you know, but we can change that also. Yeah. So we have particular ways of looking at things. This is like our default mechanism.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, we might say, I'm tired of this pattern. I need to free myself from it. So I'm going to do something like yoga or meditation.
Yeah.
And somehow you know that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
So like you go to a class or you go to a teacher
mm-hmm.
and they teach you some techniques, and those techniques essentially short circuit the pattern temporarily.
Okay.
And if we can create a new habit of short circuiting our old patterns again and again
mm-hmm.
and then replace them with a new pattern, what happens is we can't continue to indulge the old pattern making because mm-hmm. We've short-circuited enough that its energy has waned.
Mm.
And then we've imprinted at the same time a new pattern, which is going to send us on a new trajectory.
Okay.
So we've replaced an old story with a new story, and hopefully that new story is one of freedom,
mm-hmm.
of compassion, of self-reflection, really the first thing it needs to be mm-hmm. is a pattern of self-reflection. Because if we're not looking at ourselves honestly, then it's going to be another false story.
Okay.
You know, another mask that we put on of being the yoga person or a mm-hmm. spiritual practitioner.
Okay.
So I didn't answer your question
when I was first learned that.
I'm still learning that, mm-hmm. you know, that's why they say yoga is a practice yeah. or meditation is a practice mm-hmm. because like you keep learning and relearning the same basic yeah. things over and over again. There's like, basically there's nothing new has been added mm-hmm. to the entire vernacular of spiritual practice mm-hmm. in the past 5,000 years. We're just okay. recycling it okay. with different ways of saying it.
Yeah.
So I think this is one of the first things that you learn when you go to a yoga class is, okay, I can, all of a sudden I'm seeing things in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a cool thing. I want to do more of this.
Yeah.
And you instantly learn from the beginning. Everything I've, you know, the stuff going on in my mind is like a story. It's mm-hmm. just this narrative, and I attach myself to the narrative, and the more I attach myself to it, the more real it becomes mm-hmm. and the more stuck I become.
Okay.
So we got to free ourselves from the narrative.
Yeah. And when were you, what were you doing in your life that you came upon yoga and heard that concept? Or did someone say the concept to you, or did you sort of figure it out from doing yoga?
I think many people have said that concept to me over mm-hmm. the years, and in different types of yeah. ways as well. The first time I did yoga, I was about 15 or so. It was at a summer camp,
mm-hmm.
and it was my first experience of absolute complete nothingness in Shavasana,
mm-hmm. okay.
you know, and that was, I didn't know what it was. But I knew it was something really profound and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second exposure to it was reading Siddhartha in ninth grade, so mm-hmm. around the same time. And my English teacher, Mrs. Jane Benditson, said mm-hmm. the three most important things you need to ask yourself in your life.
Okay.
She was like, there's no getting around this. This is completely compulsory. Or who am I?
Mm-hmm.
What am I doing here? And what do I do next?
Okay.
So those are the three most important things you have to ask yourself. Who am I? What mm-hmm. am I doing here? What do I do next? And that's all I remember from high school.
Okay.
That's the only thing that's been like my guide, yeah. basically.
Feels like enough.
Since then, it's plenty to work with,
yeah.
you know, those three things and you're golden.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, set me on a path of self-reflection. And then I didn't start doing yoga like in a structured way until I was about 18 or 19.
Okay.
And then by the time I was 20, it was all I wanted to mm-hmm. do. And then I went to India.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I want to talk about that too. So would you say that your life had been leading up to that? Like when you look back on it, like, oh, it feels natural that I would have come to yoga?
Well, I don't think it's natural. I think I didn't have much of a choice.
Okay.
I mean, if you believe this thing about samskara and mm-hmm. about impressions, whatever your impressions are that are going to flower or grow forward,
mm-hmm.
like you kind of don't have a choice.
Okay.
Apparently, where we do have choice is to direct some of our path forward.
Mm-hmm.
Based on how we respond to present day circumstances with a conscious or aware mind.
Okay.
But the things that have to happen will happen no matter what. So basically everyone is like, you know,
mm-hmm.
on the path to doing what they have to
okay.
do. And if every once in a while when we get lucky enough, we can maybe alter that with some conscious decision making.
Okay.
So, you know, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Trying to make sense of
okay.
that.
Yeah. So how would one, they're on a path, let's say they have a goal, right?
Yeah.
So how would they know that they are following the path that's going to best suit them?
Yeah, this is an awesome question. It's actually something that I've been lecturing. It's something I've been lecturing about. Every year when I do my workshops,
mm-hmm.
I pick a topic. And this year, that's my topic.
Okay.
And so in the yoga system, there are four main types of yoga. There's jnana yoga, bhakti, karma, and raja.
Mm-hmm.
And bhakti is the yoga of devotion. Jnana is the yoga of the intellect or of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And karma is action, and raja is stillness or practice.
Yeah.
And each of these relate to the ways that we relate to the world around of us, the world around us, not of us. So we react to or relate to the world through thinking, acting, feeling, and through like stillness or quietness. Okay, so we think about the world, we feel things towards the world, we act in the world, and then we also have moments of stillness where we observe, basically, the witness state. So for Jnana Yoga, this is the yoga of thinking. Who am I? What am I doing here? What's my purpose? And for Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of feeling, it is for the expressing devotion and gratitude and love and service. And Karma Yoga is the yoga of action, where you see that God dwells in all beings equally, so you serve all beings. And then Raja Yoga, the yoga of stillness, is where you do things like asanas and pranayama, the traditional yoga practices and meditation, to quiet the mind. Now, it's said in different traditions, like Swami Vivekananda has spoken about this, and there's a Swami here in New York, Sarva Priyananda, who has categorized basically what kind of a mind might be drawn towards those things. So in yoga, we have like a little bit of a, it's an equation. You have a sadhaka, that's the person who's practicing something. And then you have a sadhana, which is the means to accomplish something. And then you have the sadhya, which means the goal. So there's a goal, there's a means to the goal, and then there's the person who is practicing those means. So he gives the example of bhakti yoga, that my mind, the mind of the sadhaka, is filled with desires. And the desires that I have maybe are for material things or for fame or for power or for all those types of things. And none of those desires are really bringing me happiness or satisfaction.
Some more external.
Or addressing the meaning of my life. So what I really want, my goal is to desire only the highest, to desire God or to desire, desire the sacred or to desire, you know, total self-knowledge, whatever it might be. So in order to turn my desires from temporary things to the highest goal, I'm going to use the means of devotion. So bhakti would be devotion or desire for the highest and to combat the weakness of the mind, which desires very small, limited things. And so you use chanting and ritual and service and things like that. So he has equations for all those. So how do you know, you know, which type of a person you are, you're going to automatically be drawn. If you are a person who says that I am seeking to know who I am, and that's all I'm interested in, I'm not interested in gods and goddesses, I'm not interested in ritual, I'm not interested in trying to serve people everywhere because the idea of doing something for other is doesn't exist, there are no others, there's only one. So I just want to see the oneness in everything. Then you're going to go for Jnana Yoga. And then how will you know you're going in the right path? Well, whether or not it's working, because the proof is in the pudding. But usually when we go off the path a little bit, we don't realize it until things have gone like south a little bit, you know, or someone tells us, you know, you're acting like a real jerk. Or you think you're practicing, but, you know, really you're just power tripping. And that's why it's good to have spiritual friends or a husband or a wife or a partner who will like smack you in the head when you're, you know, they will tell you what's up. And until we begin to really develop self-reflection, discrimination, and honesty with ourselves and sensitivity to knowing, like, I just said something that was not authentic, or I just did something that really didn't reflect my highest values, and then you'll know that you've gone off and you'll correct your course. So the more sensitivity we develop towards honesty within our own self-reflection, the more we'll stay on the path. Quote-unquote path.
And where were you? What category did you fall into when you get started?
Well, I fell into the category of devotion pretty quickly, but it was an unstructured devotion. I really liked chanting, and I liked ritual, and I liked the gods and goddesses. I was doing asanas and pranayama and all that stuff quite a lot. But really, I think I was drawn toward devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I do a little bit of everything. Like I read the Vedantic texts and I do some ritual, puja, and I try to do some service when I can, you know.
I try to
incorporate that as a part of my life,
okay,
not as something I just like do on a weekend or something. And then I do my yoga practice every day. So, you know, they do say, some people, that you have jnana, bhakti, and karma. These are the three types of yoga, which are knowledge, devotion, and action or service. And then raja yoga, which is also ashtanga yoga, is a synthesis of all those three types of yoga. So within ashtanga yoga, you find all the other kinds of yoga. So if you want to do the synthesis, you just do the ashtanga yoga. If you want to specialize, you do one of the others.
Okay. And that's what the yoga you were most drawn to.
Yeah, that's the yoga that I do.
Okay. And let's talk about, like you said, going to India, you went to study.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
All right. I went in 1988 for the first time. The yoga teachers I was practicing with at the time recommended that I go to India and do a teacher training program and then come back and maybe teach at their school. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
That was in 1988. And I left in the right around Christmas time and then came back about 4 months later and made going to India a yearly habit. Sometimes twice a year until my teacher passed away in 2009.
Okay.
So 21 years, once or twice a year, and now I go about every other year.
Okay.
I'm going, actually tomorrow I'm going.
Okay, yes, as you mentioned before we record it. What did you get from going to India, say the first time?
Well, India is like a totally different story. India is called the Karma Bhumi. Bhumi means land. Over here in America, we're called the Bhoga Bhumi. Bhoga means enjoyment. So in India, you work out your karmas, and in America or in the West, you work out your enjoyments and develop more karma. So India, I feel for many people, especially people on a spiritual quest, she begins to reorient our lives in a direction which was hitherto unknown to us and set us on a new trajectory. And every time I've gone to India, something has changed in my life. Every single time, especially when there were big changes afoot or something really needed to shift. I'd come back from India and things would, like, my course would be recharted. It is the birthplace and the land of yoga. I feel like yoga and spirituality in general, not just yoga, but overarching spirituality and devotion is like in the soil of India, is in the air. And I don't want to sound overly romantic or poetic, because India is a very difficult place for many, many millions of people. But one of the great strengths of India is devotion. And one of the gifts that India gave to the world is yoga. And you feel it there when you were there. The holy places of India are so profoundly out of this world. We were there in October, and we went all the way up north to a place called Kedarnath, which is a Shiva temple at 11,500 feet. And it's literally like being in another world. It's not like going high up in the mountains in Aspen or something, you know, and you know you're still like, you come down, you're fine. But you go up there to this holy place and you're really transported to, it feels like just another dimension. And you come down from the mountain and from the temple and you know I've really been in a different place, not just high up on a mountain, but in a really different place. And I don't quite know how to describe it other than it's real.
Okay. And how long would you usually your trips when you stay there?
It depends. Our longest trip was 15 months. That was very tiring. And average 3 to 4 months was generally how long we would stay.
Okay.
And now the trips are shorter, usually 2 weeks to a month.
Okay. So when you come back to the States, do you have to like readjust your mind or?
No. No. You know, I'm from New York City. I grew up in Greenwich Village. I'm used to a little bit of chaos.
And
so I love India. It was never culture shock for me. It was like mainly total, you know, zapped my enthusiasm for doing the things I do.
Okay. And I know in the book you talk about these selves, like these things are characters we have of our... Yeah, character is probably a way to say it. That, you know, I'm a yogi, or as in the book you talk about, I was a goth.
Yeah.
And I was a punk rocker.
Yeah.
And then just trying to get to our real selves.
Yeah.
How did you get to your, which I guess is a process, right?
Yeah.
But how did you like shake off those different characters?
Well, I, as far as I'm concerned, I'm still going through characters.
Okay.
You basically shake off one of those characters when you get tired of it and you decide to take on a new character.
Yeah.
And then hopefully the new character you take on is bringing you a little bit closer towards truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as long as we are walking around in these human bodies, we're always going to be some type of a character.
Yeah.
I think now I'm wondering if I can like just fully be the character that I am. And that will be me, you know, like, and that's all there will be to it.
Yeah.
Like, whatever my character is, like, just, I need to embody it and be it. And I don't quite know what that is yet, but, you know, it's too malleable at this point. So I question it. I look at it. I, you know.
So what would you say to people who are like, okay, they're not going to go the path of you are, but they just want life to be a little better.
Yeah.
So yoga, meditation, like how would that actually help
people? I think that's like basically my goal also. Like I'm not running towards enlightenment or anything like that like I was when I was younger and had more energy. I still have a lot of energy.
Yeah.
But
many won't go to India for 15 months.
Exactly. So. No, that's okay because the food's not quite my palate.
Okay.
You know, after a while, I don't want to eat rice anymore. I think that just wanting to feel a little better in your own skin is a very good goal to have, and I think that's just enough. Because when we feel like a little bit better and there's a little bit of opening, we relate to people better, like I'm nicer, I'm more thoughtful towards my wife and my daughter. I get the things done that I need to. So I think that just this little bit of reorientation towards like, I feel a little bit better, you know, my mind is a little more calm is good. That's plenty. And if we had more people just feeling that way, a little more centered in themselves and connected just slightly, I think the world would definitely be a better place. I think there would be a lot less aggression, a lot less judgment of other people. A judgment to the point of condemning people for their beliefs or for their, you know, the color of their skin or for whatever it might be. And so I think that's like a super good goal. So what should those people do? You know, I think anything, some physical exercise, cleaning up your diet, sleeping more if you're not sleeping enough. A little yoga is always helpful, a couple of minutes of meditation. Deep breathing for like 5 minutes a day or 3 minutes a day is a very good thing to do and doesn't require you to go to a class or anything like that. Just like take some really deep breaths for a few minutes. Smooth and steady, not like hyperventilating. You know, smooth, slow, steady, deep breaths is enough to clear your mind a little. And I think essentially what we need is because the mind gets so crowded with input all the time. And not just because we live in a technological age, like even people who are not on their phones all day have a lot of stress, maybe healthcare issues, you know, maybe dealing with, you know, insurance companies, maybe dealing with the government, maybe dealing with, you know, whatever, having come back from fighting a war, you know, so many different things that have nothing to do with technology. So people are blaming technology all the time for like people being more stressed out now. The world is, the nature of the world is like, is stressful, you know? And when there's a lot of external, say, pressure pushing down on you, the thing that it affects is like your nervous system, your emotions, and your mind. And things get compacted. And what we need to do or want to do is try to create a little space. And a lot of things like cognitive behavioral therapy or any other types of therapies or simple practices like Tai Chi or breathing or whatever, what those things are doing is they're creating like a little bit of mental space so you can pull back from the pressure that you're stuck in, which is also a type of a story, but a very difficult story to extract yourself from, to just pull back from that a little and allow a little bit of space. And then you like know which direction to go into. So essentially, that's what I see a daily practice is doing, is creating a little bit of space. Mm-hmm. And in Sanskrit, the word for happiness is sukha. And su means good, and mm-hmm. ka means space. So okay. essentially, like, and sukha is said to be a result of the mind or a character of the mind when we do practices in a proper manner. Mm-hmm. We're creating more sukha.
Okay.
So what are we doing? Creating more good space. Mm-hmm. A little more space in the body, a little more space in the breath, a little more space in the emotions, mm-hmm. a little more space in our ability to step back and take a look at ourselves and the situation and then respond appropriately. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's kind of how I see it.
Okay. What was the word it means, contentment?
Santosha.
Santosha.
Yeah. Okay.
I like that because I feel like, you know, sometimes you hang out with a friend, you feel wonderful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then an hour later, someone pushes you on the subway, bumps into you, and you feel bad. Like, to not have your moods just be like, you know, willy-nilly, to actually just be more content. Like, how does one get to that? Like, talk about that.
Yeah, how does one not take everything so personally?
Yeah and your mood is then depending on events.
Yeah, when your mood depends on your own inner connection, then you are not thrown off mm-hmm. as easily. When your mood depends on external events to make you feel satisfied, then your mood will get thrown off with mm-hmm. every up and down of life. So santosha means you're content with whatever comes to you or whatever does not come to you.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those things. If it doesn't come, okay, you're happy.
Yeah.
If it does come, okay, you're happy. But your happiness doesn't depend on it coming or not mm-hmm. coming. And so that's essentially what the santosha is.
Yeah. How does one even get to that?
You practice it.
Uh-huh.
You know, you challenge yourself with small things. Things like santosha can be done, say, like you're going to do an hour or half an hour of yoga postures every day or mm-hmm. 10 minutes of meditation. You can also do 10 minutes of practicing santosha.
Okay.
You can do 10 minutes of practicing contentment. You know, mm-hmm. you can sit in front of your computer and go, okay, I wrote an email yesterday to someone. I really want a response. I'm going to open my computer. If it's there, I will be happy. If it's mm-hmm. not there, I will be happy.
Okay.
And you just...
It's a training.
It's a training.
Okay.
I know it's a training. Again, all these things are strengthened the more connected we are mm-hmm. inwardly. And when I say the more connected we are inwardly, that means that we have an inner sense of self rather than just an outward looking in the mirror sense.
Okay.
And that comes from being quiet, from being reflective. When that connection is strengthened, then mm-hmm. things like santosha are easier. But in the meantime, we can practice it.
Okay.
It's a good practice to do. And Yoga Sutras, Patanjali says that when the practice of asanas or postures is perfected, mm-hmm. then tato dvandva anabhighataha, then we transcend the pairs of opposites, which means pleasure and pain, hot and cold, success and failure, praise and blame, mm-hmm. which really is the ups and downs of life. Like, we are even-minded with the ups and downs mm-hmm. of life because we have steadied ourselves through the practice mm-hmm. of asanas.
Okay. And for somebody who would say to you, Eddie, how long is that going to take?
How long does all that take? Yeah, to be established there forever,
mm-hmm.
According to the yogis, takes many lifetimes.
Okay.
And then even at that, you know, nothing is guaranteed.
Yeah.
I'm satisfied with, you know, a few minutes here and there.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is to be able to come back to it. We should expect that our minds are going to get thrown off. And that we're not going to be perfect, and that not everything is going to be smooth.
Mm-hmm.
But what we want to do is catch ourselves as quick as we can when we go off track and come back to center.
Yeah.
Sharon Salzberg calls this the mindfulness muscle,
mm-hmm.
that you notice when your attention has gone away and you bring it back. That's actually the practice of mindfulness.
Okay.
And it's a given, you know, we're not going to do it right all the time. And when we do it wrong, then... what we need to do is, how do I get back on track?
Mm-hmm.
You know, apologize, correct our course, try not to do it again.
Mm-hmm. And not beat yourself up for not getting it always right.
Yeah. And I think it's okay to not beat yourself up for not always getting it right, as long as you're trying also to improve.
Yeah.
But if you're not trying to improve, then you should beat yourself up for not getting it right.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the book. Goes in specifics. Like, if you're going to practice yoga, like, here are physical benefits and mental benefits. If you could talk about some of that.
Sure. One of the things that I talk about in the book, called One Simple Thing, by the way, is that I feel that most yoga practices are primarily affecting the nervous system. Mm-hmm. And we have basically what's called a bottom-up approach to balancing the nervous system in yoga. A top-down approach would be you start with meditation, which is affecting mm-hmm. the prefrontal cortex primarily and the cortical folds of the brain.
Okay.
And you practice these simple techniques of awareness and self-reflection, and then that calms down the emotions, and then that calms down the brainstem functions, mm-hmm. and then everything is copacetic.
Okay.
So in yoga, what you're doing is you're not worrying about the higher functions so far. You start down with brainstem functions like respiration, mm-hmm. heart rate, digestion, sleep, blood pressure, and sexual reproduction, and all these things are ruled by the brainstem. Mm-hmm. So you start with these basic practices to stabilize the homeostatic functions of the autonomic nervous system, which are the things that keep us alive, mm-hmm. the survival functions. And in there, I propose in the book, we have a very subtle like knot between the survival functions and our identity and mm-hmm. our sense of self. So for example, if you hold your breath, at a certain point after a minute or so, or mm-hmm. maybe less, or maybe more, you're going to want to breathe.
Yeah.
So your body is telling you to breathe. Why? Because otherwise you'll die.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't hold your breath till you die anyway, but that's a sensation. If I don't breathe, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. Who's going to die? Well, I am.
Yeah.
Well, who's the I that's going to die? Well, my sense of existence, you know, my own personal yeah. whatever. So we have tied in to survival functions our narrative,
mm-hmm.
the story of who we think we mm-hmm. are. And I think what yoga is doing is by addressing, well, you can actually control your breath for a few minutes mm-hmm. every day or for an hour every day and slow it, you know, down to half of what yeah. it normally is. You can hold it comfortably for periods of time. You can do all these different types of things mm-hmm. with your breath and with your nervous system that usually are automatic and tied to your narrative so that you can start to free yourself from that story a bit. Mm. And when you free yourself a little bit from the physiological not to our identity, mm-hmm. it opens us up to higher brain functions automatically.
Okay.
Then I can open up to higher levels of compassion and understanding and love and listening and all these types of mm-hmm. things because I've controlled the very lower levels of my identity,
okay.
which are locked into my survival functions. And of course, one of the greatest things is the fear of death. So, and the fear of death is mm-hmm. linked to breathing.
Uh-huh.
When the breath goes, then we're dead. So we want breath to stay in our body for as long as possible. And that's where fear of death is coming from. It's linked to a process.
Okay.
So all of these fears we have are linked to physiological processes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think yoga is so beneficial and so helpful because it starts to say, okay, you have this fear of death built into you in your heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And your very breath, this fear of death, is built into mm. your breathing process. We need to keep this breath going or you're going to die. So you should be afraid of that.
Yeah.
Keep breathing, keep breathing. And then yogis say, okay, the fear of death is keeping you mm-hmm. from your potential. So we're going to teach you how to control your breath.
Okay.
Slow it down. Slow and calm down the breathing and your fears are going to start to subside also because you're going to see that you're not just your narrative, you're not just your story, you're not just your physiological processes,
yeah.
you're something deeper, more profound. Maybe you're pure consciousness,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is linked with the entire universe.
Okay.
Maybe your whole being is a reflection of the, you know, the mm-hmm. of the macrocosm.
Okay.
And so that's how the yogis use the practices. That's what I propose in the book.
Okay.
I passed it by a few people,
you
know, before I passed it by some scientists and mm-hmm. by some people who know the Vedas and science very well.
Okay.
And they seemed to think it was reasonable, and that's why I went forward and wrote the book. So
okay.
I checked the idea first with about
yeah.
half a dozen people.
Okay.
And when I got the okay, and these are all my, you know, I consider them elders
mm-hmm.
and mentors, and they know more than me in many
yeah.
levels. And so they said, cool. And so I went ahead and investigated it
okay.
quite a bit more.
Okay.
But that's the basis of the book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I cover a lot of other things too, but essentially what I'm getting at is why is yoga so good for so many people and why does it help so many things? Number one, it balances the functions of the autonomic nervous system,
mm-hmm.
but more profoundly, it helps to use our physiology to untie the fears that we all have within us and the false stories that we have within us that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Okay. Can you speak about yoga and stress? Because if I interpreted this right, that stress is sort of like in our head because it's how a situation occurs and then the story we tell about that situation.
Yeah, it's actually almost the opposite. And I hope that answered before I didn't go too much off track with the So basically, stress is a response of your nervous system to environmental demand. If we have, say we're attacked by an animal like a bear in the woods, your nervous system responds to that attack before your mind does and before your emotions do. Your body will start to flee before you even know what's happening. Okay. So the mind is actually the last place to process an external event.
Okay.
So stress is basically this neutral force. It can be good or bad. It acts upon the nervous system. The nervous system responds, sends messages to the brain. The brain somehow transfers that into thought. Mm-hmm. And then the thought is our idea of what the event is. So the way that yoga is helpful for dealing with environmental demand is that it trains the nervous system to perceive the world in a different kind of a way. Mm-hmm. And what this means is that we have some different branches of our autonomic nervous system, sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And this is a very sort of mundane way of talking about it. There are a little bit more developed ways of talking about these two systems now, but I'm not as familiar with them.
Okay.
So, but basically, our sympathetic nervous system, which moves us towards activity, when it goes into hyperarousal, turns into fight or flight, which is our response to an environmental demand of danger. And in our world today, what happens is anything which is an environmental demand, which is a little bit stressful, triggers this response called the stress response. And our body needs time to recover from that demand. But because the nature of society is to continually hit you with demands, we don't always have time to recover.
Okay.
So we'll have one stress after another, and it begins to build up. So eventually our nervous system is on high alert all the time. And this is the situation for many people, especially people who go to do yoga or meditation.
Yeah.
They're really going because, for the most part, that they're on high demand all the time and they need to turn off a little bit.
Okay.
So the thing that helps you turn off is activating the parasympathetic nervous system, which is repair, restoration, rest, and digest. And the way that the parasympathetic is activated is really through deep, slow, calm breathing, being in a safe space, having someone with a soothing voice talking to you, who's guiding you through nice poses, which, you know, might feel good for the body or might challenge you in a particular way, to make you stronger within that thing that you're doing. So all of these, this external environment created by a yoga class is going to help to engage the parasympathetic nervous system, which trains you to be in a non-defensive state. As your background state. Normally we're in a defensive state. Someone bumps into us in the subway, like you said, we get really pissed off. Someone says the wrong thing, we get upset. Someone doesn't answer a text right away, we get upset. These are all things everyone can relate to this stuff. That's being in a defensive state. And now what we do with the activation of this other branch of our nervous system is we're training ourselves to be in a non-defensive, open, as Stephen Porges, who's a doctor who created a theory called the polyvagal theory, says, in a pro-social state, that we are reading people properly, we're hearing people properly, we're responding in a right way, because a branch of our nervous system which allows us to do that is open, responsive, and activated, and the branch which is only to protect us from danger is not becoming over-enthusiastic when it doesn't need to be.
Okay, so...
That's what yoga basically does, for the most part. It does a lot of other things too, but one of the most important things is it trains us to activate this branch of our nervous system, which will help us be calm, safe, connected, socially engaged, socially responsive, and all those other nice things like that.
Because being in that defensive state long term affects your health.
It does. It creates inflammation in the body. And this is, it's called the vagus nerve is primarily what we're talking about, 10th cranial nerve. 80% of those nerves are going up from the gut and the visceral organs to the brain, and 20% are coming from the brain down to the gut. It's bidirectional.
Okay.
Vagus nerve is responsible for moderating or controlling inflammation in the body. And when inflammation in the body gets out of control, it creates things like inflammatory bowel syndrome, certain types of cardiovascular diseases, certain types of diabetes, certain cancers, rheumatoid arthritis, a whole host of terrible things, which are largely, some of them are preventable through diet and through exercise and yoga, meditation, etc. Inflammation in the proper doses are going to help to fight off infections, important for the immune system, and many, many other operations too. It's only when they go out of balance that they start to create a problem.
Okay.
And the vagus nerve is going to mediate it. So many of the yoga practices work directly on the vagus nerve. Postures, breathing, vocalization like chanting, and behavior. How we react to people, respond to people, and treat ourselves too. So those four things I speak about also in the book, and these are things from Stephen Porges too. He calls them neural exercises, postures, breathing, vocalization, and behavior. And when I read about this, reading his papers, I saw that these lined up exactly with all of the practices we do in yoga.
Okay.
And this is certainly why yoga is as powerful as it is. The yogis must have known what was on.
So the book is out March 12th. And it's a great book.
Thank you so much.
Yes, yes. And of course, as a major Madonna fan, I was there the night you... Well, I guess you could tell the story.
Tell me.
Yes. Well, at Madison Square Garden, when you work with Madonna to help with the dancers and all that.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
When
in November, it was in 2012.
You were in that class?
No, I was in the audience for that show.
Oh, you were in the audience?
Yes, yes,
oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, because, well, I used to teach Madonna. I taught her for, I think, about 10 years or so.
Okay.
And then she asked me to come train her dancers at one point also.
Okay.
And so that was that particular tour, and I was training them when they were doing their rehearsals in New Jersey or someplace.
Okay. How did you connect with her? Were you the one responsible when she did the one tour where she opened up with Vogue and she's like doing all the yoga poses?
Oh, was she doing yoga poses in that?
Yeah, yeah.
What tour was that?
Reinvention tour.
I don't remember what year was it. She started practicing with me in 1998.
Okay, I think it was after that.
Okay, yeah. So 1998 until like for another 10 years or so after that.
Okay.
She came to my yoga school because a friend of mine in California named Denise was teaching her or had started teaching her.
Okay.
And then recommended she practice with a friend of mine named John Campbell, who taught her a few private classes. And then John, who was assisting me at the school, my school at that time, suggested she come down to the yoga school. And so she started coming to the school. First time she came to the school was for an evening class that my wife Jocelyn was teaching. And my wife doesn't know anything about celebrities. She's from a small village in France. She doesn't care about that stuff. And but she'd heard of the name Madonna, of course. And so Madonna came to the class and Jocelyn asked her name to sign her in the book. And she said Madonna. And Jocelyn said, oh, Madonna, Madonna? And then she practiced with us, you know, for – she used to come down to our school every day, basically from the Upper West Side for in Broadway and Houston Street for a long time.
Cool. Excellent.
Yeah.
And
yeah, she was great. She did a really good practice.
Yeah, yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, very, very dedicated. And also studied the philosophy, too.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So did I leave anything out?
No, it's thank you so much for having
me.
It's
an honor
to be here. And, you know, we're all big fans of The Strand. And to be on The Strand cast is, like, amazing.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you for doing this, Eddie.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed the Strandcast conversation with Eddie Stern. Pick up your copy of One Simple Thing in store at 828 Broadway or online at strandbooks.com. You can also stay in the Strand loop on all social media at Strand Bookstore. As for me, I can be found on social media at This Is Boyce. I also host a music interview podcast, Talk Music Talk, where I have long-form conversations with people connected to music. For more information, just visit talkmusictalk.com. And if you missed anything, you'll find all the details in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to The Strandcast. Make sure you subscribe wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Until next time, keep on reading.